wage. Orman Voss examined this at a citizens' forum in June, and we have some of the participants with us this hour. Delores Hurt is co-chair of the League of Women Voters Study Group on the Living Wage, and an old colleague of mine from days gone by at WIS, the wonderful Iodine State in Columbia. Delores Hurt, welcome to the program. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And she's with us in our Spirit Square studio. Joining us by phone is Alexandra Forter-Sirota. She is the director of Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center, which recently produced its 2014 Living Income Standard, providing measures of what families around the state need to achieve an adequate standard of living. Joins us by phone from Raleigh. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also with us in our studio is Carol Hardison, the Chief Executive Officer of Crisis Assistance Ministry. Hard to say, but you do good work, and you're on the front lines of what we're talking about every single day. Thank you for being back with us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Delores, let me start with you. Why is the League of Women Voters involved in studying?
Has a long tradition of informing ourselves and others about political issues, policy issues. So this year, our local league decided to study a living wage to see how it could help out our citizens here in the Charlotte area. So we formed the study group, and we've collaborated with other organizations like the Crisis Assistance Ministry, like the Budget and Tax Center, to see what would be feasible here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg County. We, as a here worker.
Now, the North Carolina Justice Center released a report on the living wage. Did they do that at your request, or had they already done it when you started to study this?
I think Alexandra can best answer that for you. This is something they've been doing for years, and it's done, like, I think every couple of years.
So then why need to study it yourself when you have their report to go by?
We have to form a consensus within the League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. Once we form a consensus, our members will say, yes, this is something we want to advocate for. Feel we can go out and have a real impact on the community in terms of addressing the issues.
And you had this meeting in June, this citizen meeting, I think, in June. Who showed up for that? How many people showed up? What did they have to say?
We had about 70 people showing up. We had quite a few UE150 members. They are...
What's that?
They are a union for city workers here in town. They have actually been speaking with the county manager and city council members of the possibility of a living wage.
You know, in area, I said at the beginning of the program, Alexandra, that I think five municipalities, counties, cities, towns in the state have enacted ordinances about the living wage. What are we precisely talking about? How can a government say you must pay this? Tell me how it works.
Right, and I think this is an important opportunity for Charlotte to lead on, given Charlotte's leadership on so many other economic issues in the state, being now well into the recovery and showing the strongest job growth. The potential to grow good quality jobs is very great in Charlotte. What we know is that a living wage ordinance in North Carolina right now would be established primarily for city and county workers. The way that it would work would be the city or county, the city council or county commission would vote to establish a wage standard more in line with what it takes to make ends meet. Above that is the minimum wage, which we know is insufficient to really allow families to make ends meet. And they would do that through an ordinance that would apply to city and county workers. What we know is that when this has happened, it's also had an impact on surrounding businesses and private businesses. We know that in other cities in North Carolina, there are voluntary programs where businesses pay a living wage, recognition for that living wage. So there's a tremendous potential if Charlotte moves forward with a city or county ordinance to establish a living wage for their workers to set a precedent for the broader community of employers and really demonstrate that this is a path forward for our economy in a very difficult time for many working families.
Now, Delores mentioned that your organization, North Carolina Justice Center, has been studying this issue for 20 years, and you issue reports from time to time, and you use your research, evidently, to inform the public policy debate. How would you assess the impact you've had thus far?
Well, it's interesting. We produce the Living Income Standard for all 100 issue of a living wage in the state, and then an effort that was successful in our state to raise the minimum wage above what the federal minimum wage was. So at some time, North Carolina was actually operating under a minimum wage that was higher than the federal level. So we feel this product and this discussion has had some policy impact. Certainly today we know that we need to revisit this issue because so many families are struggling to make ends meet. So many of the jobs that are being created are poverty wage jobs. And in order to support that stronger connection to better paying jobs, a living wage is one way to do that.
I want to come back before the end of the program to talk about these new jobs that are being created that are poverty wage jobs, because these are some of the jobs being touted by the job-creating politicians. They point to these jobs and say, look at all the jobs we've created, and what you're saying is that they don't pay a living wage, so what good are they? I mean, they're some good, obviously, but not enough.
Right.
I want to come back to that later in the program. Carol Hardison is on the front lines of all this because you were with Crisis Assistance Ministry, and I threw out all these figures at the top of the program. Numbers don't mean a lot to a lot of people, but actually witnessing what these numbers mean might. So who are these people that you deal with who are working? They're not, sloughing off. They're not sitting in the corner watching Oprah, unless they have to because they got nothing else to do because they can't get a job. But they are working, and they still can't feed their families. Who are these folks?
That's right. That's the woman that I talked to yesterday, Mike, who has a college degree and works at a local electrical supplier. And she has two growing teenage boys. And she said, I've got to figure out how to get clothes. And they continue for school. They continue to eat her house and home. And so she has just become a driver for Uber, if you will, and drives 25 miles to downtown Charlotte every night at 10 o'clock and waits for Uber calls. So she'll be able to get her kids ready for school this fall.
So she's working several jobs.
Several jobs. And as was referred to earlier, when you put together all of the costs, the food, especially with growing teenage boys, a father who does not pay child support and hasn't for years, and health expenses, transportation expenses. So last year, Crisis Assistance Ministry served 55,000 people, many like this woman.
Mm. Let's talk about the 2014 Living Income Standard Report that the North Carolina Justice Center recently released. I quoted one of your findings in the opening, and that is that a North Carolina family with two adults and two children require an income of $52,275 a year to afford the basic necessities. Is that a state average? Would it be slightly less in rural areas, more so in Charlotte or perhaps in Raleigh? How would you assess that?
Right, and that is a state average. And what we know is that Mecklenburg County is one of the higher cost counties in the state. So for a family of four in Mecklenburg County, it would be $55,000, closer to $55,000.
How many four-person families in the state do not earn? It's gotten worse, better, stayed the same for the poor over the last 20 years? And how do we compare to other states?
So what we've seen is that the number of employed persons in jobs whose average wages are below the living income standard has increased slightly since 2007. So there are now 84% of employed persons are in jobs that are on average paying below the living income standard. What we've also seen over the course of the recovery is that many costs are folks taking on extra jobs, doing without, taking on greater debt in order to find that balance in their household budget.
We've heard a lot about the disappearing American middle class. We've heard a lot of conversation about the 1% versus the 99%, and I suppose that is why the National Bureau of Economic Research conducted a study on upward mobility, which discovered that Charlotte was at the bottom of 50 cities. Carol must witness the difficulty.
Nationally, we need people to make more money and therefore be able to buy goods to improve the economy overall.
Henry Ford knew this.
Yes, he did.
How come? Why don't we know it still?
There's always been an aspect of business where profits are the most important thing, and therefore the workers are left behind. I'd like to mention that as far back as...
Tell you what, let's mention it after the break because we've got to take one. We'll come back with Dolores Hurt, who's the co-chair of the study group on the living wage, who share their very different stories with us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Secretary of State Kerry heads to Cairo to seek a ceasefire. The latest on the crisis between Israel and Hamas and prospects for a truce.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning.
As revealed, I suppose you could say, by the recent study by the North Carolina Justice Center and their Budget and Tax Center. Alexandra Forter Sirota is the director of Phone Folly. In our studio, Carol Hardison, CEO of Crisis Assistry. Dolores is the co-chair of a study group on the living wage for the League of Women Voters here. And Lindsay Ware is also with us now. She's a member of North Carolina Raise Up. That's a fast food workers union, a graduate of the Art Institute of Charlotte. Lindsay has worked in fast food for 5 years, but if
honestly, I think that people don't really realize that if you give an average middle class worker $15 an hour, we go buy houses, we buy cars, we pay our bills off and our debts off, and that money flows right back into the economy, and it will help boost the local economies. People don't understand that the more money you give us, the more money we spend. When you give these big top CEOs these billions and billions of dollars that they're making, it becomes zero in bank accounts that never get spent. When you give it to us, we flow the money right back into the economy.
So, and also during the 1930s with the New Deal era, Franklin Roosevelt said, "No business which depends for existence on paying less than a living wage to its workers has any right to continue in this country." So those are strong arguments for a living wage, and I believe the American people now as a whole can appreciate those viewpoints and recognize, as Lindsay said, that we need to have people who can earn a decent rate in fruits of the corporations that they're working for.
Now, historically, people have moved to cities for advancement purposes because there was more economic opportunity in cities. So people left the farms, and that happened here during the textile era. People left the farms to go work in the mills because there was more chance to make a living and support a family. Is that still true today, or is it simply too expensive to live in a city for most people today?
Not necessarily, because if you look at it, in North Carolina, say I wanted to move to New York, if I already can, people aren't migrating and moving because we don't have the money.
Well, that leads to a question of choices, because that's interesting that people know. I mean, there are plenty of McDonald's workers and Burger King workers and fast food workers throughout New York City, one of the most expensive places in the country to live, and they choose to live there. Mm-hmm. You say it's affordable to live there because it's not affordable to live here. It'd be less so there. So you've made a choice not to do that. What about other choices that involve that you have to make?
What me to do? I graduated from high school. I didn't have any babies. I went to college, and I tried to get my degree, and I got my degree, but I had to work miserably hard. And it came down to the point, do we buy groceries to eat, or do I pay my tuition? And it shouldn't be like that. I did what society told me to do.
Where did you get your degree? You went to the
Art Institute in culinary.
In culinary.
Yes, sir.
And you've worked in fast food for how long?
For 5 years.
5 years. Why fast food?
Just because when I was in college, when I was in high school, such payments, and it still wasn't enough. I think I owe about $52,000 in student loans.
So what does your degree qualify you to do?
I can be a line cook or an executive chef in a restaurant. I have a culinary background. I can go into catering. I could go work on a cruise ship. I could be a line cook.
Please tell me that pays better than fast food, does it?
Way better. Starting off as a line cook in the industry is about $10 to $12 an hour.
And what kind of jobs have you held in fast food?
I was a cat.
More than $50 an hour now?
Yes, sir.
So you've broken into the living wage category, would you say? No.
No. Because even $11 isn't enough for you to live on your own. If you think about it, you have rent, lights, water, electricity.
Right.
And then on top of that, I have student loan payments, and then I have a cell phone payment.
So I'm just curious about this. This has very little to do with this program. But when you went to school and you incurred $50,000 in debt to go to school and get your degree, which qualifies you to do now what you do, mm-hmm. did you know then that it wasn't going to pay enough to live on?
Mm-hmm.
You did. Then why wouldn't
keep young people? We did what society told us to do. We're not selling drugs. I'm not out here just trying to dribble a ball to get a check. I went to college. I wrote papers. I graduated. I did exactly what I was told to do, and I still can't make it ahead. So it comes to the point, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and I can't make it. So what's wrong with this picture?
Mm-hmm.
Something's got to be wrong.
Are there paths for an advancement in what you do today?
Oh, yes,
in other
yes,
words,
yes.
Are you stuck at $11 an hour for the rest
of your
life? I would
have stayed in school to continue my bachelor's degree, but my tuition a month went up from $672. It's come to the point that I can no longer depend on my local government to raise a minimum wage, and I can't depend on these big CEOs to pay their workers more, so I have to work even harder to get ahead. But that's why I'm a part of North Carolina Raise Up. We're a movement of fast food workers who go on strike, and we go on conferences, and we're demanding $15 an hour in North Carolina. That's the same reason Seattle got $15 an hour, because they organized, they struck, and they protested until they got their $15 an hour.
Are you good at what you do?
I'm really good at what I do.
Why don't you change jobs or change where you work or what, in other words, you could do if you acted upon it, to get to that $15?
There is stuff that I could do. I could go and enroll back in school and get a higher degree. That way I'll be overly qualified to get a job.
Yeah.
And, Mike, I don't think the onus should necessarily be on the worker. What about all these huge corporations who are reaping in huge profits? They have a role to play in this society also.
The guy who owns McDonald's, I don't know if you guys know this, he brought in his pocket last year $83 billion, but he couldn't afford to give his workers benefits.
Let's talk about that. McDonald's is always pointed out as the bugaboo here, because a lot of kids, a lot of young people, a lot of people, young and old, have gone through McDonald's as employees. And there's Burger King. We don't want to single them out. There's Burger King. Yeah. There's KFC. There's Taco Bell. There are all these fast food restaurants. And people look at McDonald's and they say, look at that. Major corporation, and they're paying their workers nothing. And as you just said, the CEO probably made a gazillion dollars last year. But that's the corporation. The stores, like the McDonald's on South Boulevard, is probably owned by a franchisee.
But even then, that's not the issue. These big corporations need us as workers to run their stores.
The franchisees buy the right to run a McDonald's in a particular location. They are small business people. They are entrepreneurs. They have invested and risked their own capital mm-hmm. on doing this. And there's only so much the market will bear, it seems to me. So it's not the corporation that's deciding you're going to make whatever you're making. It's what the market will bear.
North Carolina is that entrepreneurs and small businesses are coming to the realization that it does make sense for their business models and for their cost structure to pay a living wage. And that's because what they get when they do pay a living wage is employees who are more committed to the work, less likely to leave the job and thus create higher costs to retrain and address turnover in a company, that there's a tremendous benefit to the employer when you pay the living wage to workers. And so across the state, and Asheville is a great example, where they have more than 300 businesses in the Asheville area who have committed to paying a living wage to their workers. They've done that voluntarily, seeing that there is a great benefit not just to their company but to their broader community in doing so. And I think across the country you see these models of business leaders who recognize
that. Let's walk through this. If I don't know how many line cooks or cashiers at fast food restaurants have families of four, but let's just there must be a few people who are mm-hmm. who have families of four, more than a few. So if I did the math correctly, and you can correct, I'm math challenged, so, but if I did the math correctly, in order for an adult with a spouse and two children to earn this basic living wage, $52,275 a year, they would have to make $25 an hour for 40 hours of work 52 weeks a year. Is that economically feasible for some of these fast food or low wage paying jobs to pay? Can somebody afford to pay a McDonald's hamburger flipper $25 an hour?
We're really not talking about one worker making that amount of money. We're basically talking about two people bringing in $25 an hour.
That's $12.50.
Mm-hmm. Yes, $12.50 an hour.
And they can
and
afford
that,
to
I
do.
Think-
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and that I do think is feasible. I think we know that there has been over the past 30 years a great divide among the productivity of workers and their ability to capture the benefits of that productivity through higher wages. Wages have been stagnating in our state for over that period, and in fact falling over the past two decades for the median worker. And what we can begin to see is the potential for a greater alignment between the profits being earned by businesses and the wages being paid to workers. So $12.50 an hour, I think, is not an unreasonable opportunity for both the business and workers to contribute to a stronger economy in the long run.
So if Lindsay, if your figures are right, if $7.50 an hour is the average pay of a fast food worker, that's a $5 an hour raise. What would that do to the price of a hamburger, French fries, and a Coke?
And that's why that's the biggest misconstrued conception. Everybody thinks that if you give us $15 an hour, if you give us $12 an hour, then a burger is going to go from $1 to $6, and that's not the case. It wouldn't work like that. It's not that it wouldn't be hard and it wouldn't break the bank for them to pay their workers more. One, because these corporations are the ones who have McDonald's, who have Phoenix Taco. They make in a lot of money. They have enough without breaking their pockets to pay their workers more. Because if you don't have your workers in the window smiling at customers, then you don't have customers. So if you don't keep your workers happy, then we don't want to keep your customers happy.
I can't remember the last time a fast food worker smiled at me or even spoke to me, quite honestly.
And it's probably because we're in miserable hot kitchens. We work in horrible conditions. I'm there because they cut my hours.
The hate to be devil's advocate. That's my job on this program.
Fine.
The first time I went to McDonald's, I was a much younger person, probably 10, and hamburgers were, I think, 25 cents, French fries were 15 or something like that, and Cokes were 10 cents. And I don't know that the working conditions were any worse, but everybody was friendly. Everybody said thank you, please, and thank you. And it was much quicker than it is today. You could get in and out of there in 5 seconds.
But you also have to look at the decade difference. You have to look at the time difference. Back then, it was feasible to live off of, you know, that amount of money. That wasn't expensive. 25 and 50 cents wasn't expensive back
then. I'm thinking that perhaps also that a lot of this has to do with a lot of these jobs were never meant to be life-supporting jobs. They were meant to be part-time jobs for kids in high school, on the weekends, at night, after school, and not jobs to support families.
I think that's a really important point, Mike, because one of the things that I think is a misconception out there is that fast food workers in particular are kids in high school, and that's no longer the case. Most fast food workers across the country and in North Carolina are older, and they have a family, and they have children that they need to support. And so I think what we've seen is this shift in where the jobs are. And I want to go back to that bigger issue that we're facing in North Carolina's recovery, which is there are very limited options for workers to move to better jobs. First of all, we still face a jobs deficit in the state of more than 500,000 jobs. That means that for every job opening, there are 3 unemployed workers trying to get into that job. So we have a lack of jobs. The jobs that are available are paying low wages, and increasingly folks are moving into these kinds of positions where the potential for mobility, the potential to support their families are very limited.
We've been talking. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carol.
I also want to talk about the smiling worker that you experienced versus today. So today that worker could have just gotten a call from the principal that their kid's sick and they can't go.
Right.
They could be suffering with a migraine, and they have to still serve that hamburger. And so it's a large system out there that is not supporting workers like it used to.
And what people fail to realize, you saw them smiling because you were on the outside of the counter and you were paying them to serve you your food, and that's why they were smiling. But you don't know what it's like to be in the drive-thru window and people are cussing you out over the speaker box because you're telling them, hey, I'm sorry, it's going to be 4 minutes before I can give you your chicken nuggets, and people are literally cussing you out over it.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Fish July 25th at the PNC Music Pavilion, Charlotte. Tickets available at livenation.com. As Secretary of State John Kerry heads to Cairo to seek a ceasefire after the deadliest day so far for both sides in Gaza, Diane Rehm and her guests will take a look at the latest on the crisis between Israel and Hamas, and the prospects for a truce coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or Facebook or Twitter will get you to us. And we are coming right back.
College is more expensive than ever, but what do you get for your money?
We need to have a national discourse that underscores the broader purposes of education and makes education not simply a tool for getting a job.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the president of Harvard, next time on Marketplace from APM.
That's Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the living wage, the need for it here in North Carolina, and we'll get into talking about the municipalities that have already enacted this living wage a little bit and more. With Alexandra Forter Sirota, she's director of the Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center. Lindsay Ware is a member of NC Raise Up. We'll talk more about that organization, which is working for fast food workers to raise their pay. Carol Hardison, CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry, and Dolores Hurt, co-chair of the study group on the living wage with the League of Women Voters. Statewide, one in five families of four do not earn a living wage, which I would presume puts them into the poverty category. Is that true? And if so, what is Charlotte's poverty rate? Does anybody know?
Charlotte currently is just over 15% poverty rate, Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
And that's worse than the rest of the state, more less than the rest of the state, or do we know?
So, Alexandria, I know that it's been normally, Charlotte was ahead of the rest of the state. Where are we right now?
Yeah, Charlotte is doing better on that measure than the rest of the state. There are about 17% of North Carolinians living in poverty. One important thing about the poverty measure, for a family of four, the poverty level is $23,000 a year. Okay. So when we're talking about what that means and we're talking about a living wage, the distinction can be quite vast, right? The making ends meet on $23,000 a year is a whole different math equation than making ends meet on $52,000. And so I think it's really important that we also have a conversation about just how flawed our poverty measure is, just how flawed our minimum wage standard is, both of which really don't match up with the economic realities today in our state and in our country. And what we see as a result is that so many families are struggling to make ends meet.
And I read yesterday that the poverty rate today in Charlotte, I think, is the highest in 30 years and possibly the highest ever. You're nodding in agreement, Carol.
Absolutely.
So what's driving that?
And also think about it. So we're just at 1 million here in Mecklenburg County. We're hitting 1 million. So it's also the highest rate with the largest population we've ever had as a community. Mm-hmm. There's over 150,000 people. It's really a time for our community to talk about, do we have a priority? Are we going to have a community consciousness around making decisions
so
that are going to lead our low-income workers to be full participants in the economy?
So it is not, if Lindsay is a good example, if she covers a lot of people, it is not a lack of education, it is not a lack of drive, a lack of willingness to get out there and get your hands dirty and work more than 40 hours a week. It's the fact that we have a dearth of higher-paying jobs. Is that what you're saying?
We have in North Carolina lost a lot of middle wage jobs. What we're seeing in North Carolina in the recovery is the boom in ultra low wage jobs, poverty wage jobs, and some growth in higher wage jobs. You certainly see this in a place like Charlotte. You see it in a place like Research Triangle Park, where there are high wage jobs that are growing. But the pathway into those high wage jobs via a low-wage job where most folks are working is very difficult. We don't have the ladders or the connections between those low-wage jobs and those high-wage opportunities. And that's an area where we know that state policy can have a really important role to play in making sure that college is affordable, that folks don't have to take on debt and incur that additional cost at the level that Lindsay's talked about.
And Lindsay, you're a member of NC Raise Up. This is an organization trying to get raises. Is it just for fast food workers, or is it for workers in other industries as well?
For fast food workers, we do team up with other organizations and other unions that support us, and we support them, but we're for fast food workers.
And are there, how many other organizations are working? Because the unions in North Carolina are not popular entities, so which could explain also why wages are low, one could presume. But are there other organizations working in other industries as well as you are?
I cannot answer that question.
I think there are in North Carolina, among farm workers, among folks working in manufacturing, there are groups that are working, and there are a number of organizations like Carol's who are also providing that support to families and communities across the state. And they're seeing very much the same kinds of stories as people come through their doors, of the kinds of struggles that families face.
So what do you think you should be making in fast food?
I believe that we should be making $15 an hour.
And have you talked either in your capacity as a person who works for a fast food organization, mm-hmm. or as a person representing NC Raise Up, have you talked to owners of fast food businesses about what they pay and what they could afford to pay?
Yes, but the
And what do they tell you?
We're semi-skilled workers, and we don't deserve $15 an hour because we're semi-skilled workers. They can get anybody to come in without an education and work the line in a fast food restaurant or work the grill, but that's not the case. Because when you fill out an application, you either have to be enrolled in high school or have a GED to even get a job, but we're semi-skilled workers who don't need an education to work the job. Mm-hmm. That's what they tell us.
How much I don't mean to belittle this, because who am I? But how much skill do you need to make a hamburger?
What would these businesses do without their workers?
And the thing is, how much skill do you need to make a hamburger? You don't need a lot of skill to make a hamburger. But what do you do, me coming from Taco Bell, when I've got 4 12-packs of tacos on my screen and my window says I got 2 minutes to get out? It may think in your mind it don't take a lot of skill, but it takes a lot of skill just to cook in general, especially when you're on the line and you got ticket times to keep.
Right.
It's not so much about making the burger. It's how fast you can make it and make it correctly.
And don't forget, you've got to smile.
And walk
to
smile. And walking in the door, that could be difficult for somebody new to the business. You have a lot. You're like a juggler,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and you can't let the balls drop.
Nope, you have to be able to multitask.
Okay, but now let me turn this around a little bit, because people will say things if I don't turn it around. So I'm going to play devil's advocate again here. A lot of people who are not making the living wage have three children. Have the big screen color TV, have a computer or two in the house. Now, if you know you're only making $7.50 an hour, and you're not as responsible, perhaps, as Lindsay has been here, why do you launch off into having families?
Because a lot of people don't realize that's the problem with society. Everybody has such a narrow view on things that happen. You have to look at everybody goes through life. What do you tell these young girls who got pregnant at a young age and they couldn't finish high school and they couldn't go to college because they had a child? So instead of them going to get on the system, or they tried to go get on the system and still weren't allowed to because they weren't -2 below poverty, what do you tell them? You tell them, oh, I can't buy a flat screen TV, but my kids, what do I do for my kids? It's not fair that, like, if I had children, in my eyes, it wouldn't be fair that I can't buy my kid an iPod because I don't make enough money, so they have to go to school and get picked on because they don't have the new clothes and they don't have the new cell phone and they don't have the new shoes. That's not fair to my children to have to suffer. They didn't do anything.
Carol?
I think it goes back, frankly, I think we're getting into moral issues and consciousness around community and values. We're just not a society that punishes people for either their mistakes or accidents that happen to them. Now, that's the vast majority of people that come to Crisis Assistance Ministry. They were on their own in an apartment paying their bill and working, or else they wouldn't come to us faced with the loss, the threat of the loss. And so an accident occurs, and you're in the emergency room, and you find yourself with missed work, unimaginable bills, and trying to make ends meet. We're just not a society, I don't believe, that doesn't forgive that.
And this is where we get into this asset poverty. People who have a lot of money or have assets don't understand, perhaps as well as they could, because they've never had to face it, what having no assets can do to a person. We talk a lot about being one paycheck away from having to come to crisis assistance ministry. So if you lose your job or you get sick and you can't work that week and you're an hourly worker and you don't get paid that week, then you have to come and get help at a soup kitchen or at crisis assistance ministry. You can't build assets if you're living paycheck to paycheck. You earn money, then you can save, and once you save, you can make investments on whether it's investments in the stock market or investments in buying a house or whatever. And that's how it works. And a lot of the people never get a chance to do that. Is that what we're talking? And you certainly can't do that without making a living wage, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And we have to understand that although we are very much a work-oriented society here in the United States, we do deserve to have some pleasures, don't we? And if we can't afford to travel to Mexico or travel abroad to the French Riviera for a vacation, at least we can have a color TV to enjoy if we can't go to the movies, that kind of thing. So don't berate our low-wage earners because they have a color TV, for example.
And I think what nobody has hit on yet, I can't speak for any other state, but North Carolina's constitution was written on moral values. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention, but we've been doing Moral Monday rallies in Raleigh on Mondays, and we're talking about these different issues. If you look at our constitution, it was written on moral values. It is immoral to not pay a man a living wage. It is immoral.
And Alexandra, not only evidently do we have too many low-wage jobs, which leads us to the topic that we're talking about today around the state and in Charlotte, your recent report talks about what you're calling ultra-low-wage industries that have increased here since 2009. What kind of industries are we talking about, and what are they paying?
Right. So we're talking about a lot of occupations in the service sector, dishwashers, housekeeping, maids, a lot of folks who are working to provide basic services in communities. I think, you know, we know in the current debate, even at the state level, teachers are earning, in some cases, below a living wage. You know, we know that it takes 15 years for a teacher to get to $40,000 a year. That would be below a living wage if they had two children. So there are a whole host of workers in our communities who are struggling. And the explosion in ultra-low wage jobs or poverty wage jobs has been significant. More than 80% of the jobs created since the end of the recession were in industries that pay workers less than $33,000 a year.
So are these the jobs that political job creators point to when they say the jobs have been created since the Great Recession?
The vast majority of the jobs that have been created since the Great Recession have been poverty wage jobs. And I think as we listen to our policymakers talk about the boom in job creation, which frankly hasn't been a boom, but even if you are to accept there has been some job creation, we can't deny that, the quality of those jobs really does matter. If we want our economy to be sustainable over the long term, we need families to be able to support themselves.
The poor, and particularly the working poor, it seems unfair to wag fingers at them, but a lot of finger wagging takes place. And it takes place by people who I think would be appalled if they thought the other way around. Because I read yesterday that some of this is costing the society a lot.
Sure.
If you don't make a living wage, you do have to depend on philanthropic organizations like crisis assistance ministries, and in some cases, food stamps and Medicaid. So could it be argued that the lack of paying a living wage is causing society, is causing taxpayers to subsidize major corporations?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely been well documented in the research that when employers don't pay a living wage, the rest of us taxpayers make up the difference. And I think what we need to get to is that shared role. Employers need to be paying an adequate wage for their workers, And we need to have a strong support system in place at the state level as well. We need to get back to that place where government has a role to play and the private sector has a role to play in ensuring that quality job creation and support for working families happens.
Lindsay?
I just want to say something really quick. I want to correct the statement you just made because you said so they have to depend on these organizations. So I can depend on soup kitchens. I can't depend on Medicaid and I can't depend on Social Security and I can't depend on food stamps because in fast food, I make too much money to qualify for food stamps. I make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. So I work, okay, when I was in college, I went to try to apply for food stamps because I didn't have enough money for food. And she told me I didn't qualify because I made too much money. And then she looked at me and the lady goes, well, are you pregnant? I could give you food stamps if you were pregnant. And I said, okay, that doesn't make any sense. If I had a job that paid me enough money, I wouldn't be in here asking you for your help. But you're telling me I don't qualify.
Okay, well, you've made your point. Let me bring in some things here, but we have 2 minutes left. John emails, both sides of the debate have good points on what kind of wage structure companies should have. However, the marketplace should dictate the value of low-wage jobs, and no side should force the other to subscribe to its viewpoint. Minimum wage mandates are akin to price fixing and will distort the marketplace and cost jobs. Also, many startups can't afford to pay $15 an hour.
Well, I think what we've seen over the history of the existence of a wage floor, and that's what the minimum wage is intended to be, a wage floor, is that it's needed to ensure that there's a basic standard of living that families can meet. What's happened is because the minimum wage hasn't adjusted over time is that its value for the individual worker has eroded. There's a really critical role for policy to set a minimum floor, wage floor in our country.
I have 30 seconds left. Greg emails, I think we need more specifics on what a family of four is doing without if income is, say, $50,000. How are these families suffering? What basics do they not have? What do they have to give up? Very quickly. Anybody know?
Carol.
I see health, I'm chronic pain and no way to get assistance. Education for children is suffering when they're hungry. And
it goes on and on.
Basic social capital breakdown.
And which cities and counties have passed in North Carolina these living wage ordinances?
We have Durham County. We have the city of Asheville. We have the city of Durham. We have Buncombe County, as well as Orange County.
Dolores Hurt is co-chair of the study group on the living wage at the League of Women Voters here in Charlotte. Carol Hardison, CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry. Alexandra Forder-Sirota is director of the Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center. She joined us by phone. And Lindsay Ware is a member of NC Raise Up. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services. Flood season is here. Build an ARC, Awareness, Responsibility, and Knowledge, ARK, can protect families and property from flooding. ARC details, stormwater.charmec.org.
I'm Silvia Poldroli. In Italy, we treat our cars like family. They stand by us and give us years of loyal service, no matter how many Roman relics we sideswipe. So when it's time to say ciao bella to your old car, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Call 1-866-789-8627
or go to WFAE.org.
And that doesn't mean you're giving your car to Italy. It means you're giving your car to, to NPR. They couldn't drive our cars over there. There's no place on the sidewalk to park them. All right. Immigration reform has been under discussion for years, and nothing seems to change. We're going to talk about this tomorrow, particularly in light of the unaccompanied minors fleeing Central America and crowding onto our southern border. And we'll also talk to two immigrants about their very unique stories. That's tomorrow at 9. And there's no such thing as very unique. They're unique stories. Cloudy, chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. High should be in the mid-80s, lower 70s tonight with more of the same. And actually more of the same tomorrow. Upper 80s. It's summertime. What do you expect? 73 degrees right now at listener funded. 90.7 WFAE Charlotte. 90.3 WFHE Hickory. Charlotte's NPR news source.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Cairo yesterday. They'll try to broker a ceasefire between Israel and the militant Palestinian group Hamas. Their visit follows some of the deadliest days of fighting between Israelis and Palestinians since the last ground war in 2009. More than 500 Palestinians, 27 Israelis have died since fighting began July 8th. Israeli fighters say their mission is to destroy a network of cross-border tunnels that Hamas is using to infiltrate Israel. The latest on the crisis in Gaza and prospects for a truce, first the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A train carrying the bodies of those who died on the downed Malaysia Airlines jet has arrived in Kharkiv, Ukraine. The bodies were released by pro-Russian separatists. They had put the bodies in refrigerated rail cars. The militants have also handed over flight data recorders from the jet to Malaysian investigators. European Union foreign ministers are under pressure to take a unified stance against Russia after the downing of the passenger plane. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels. It's not yet clear how far European governments are willing to go.
With widespread suspicion, Ukrainian rebels shot down MH17 with a Russian-supplied missile, killing more than 200 European citizens. EU foreign ministers are being forced to look at their own government's arms sales to Moscow. Some nations have come out in favor of an arms embargo. Lithuania's foreign minister, Linas Linkevičius, says if the EU doesn't move forward with tougher sanctions against Moscow, its inaction contributes to what he calls terrorist acts.
It must be a turning point in our mindset. I don't know what else should happen in order to understand with whom we are dealing.
But it's unlikely foreign ministers will go so far now as to cut off weapon sales. They are likely to put visa bans and asset freezes on close associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting Egyptian officials in Cairo today. They're seeking ways to tamp down the violence in Gaza. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports it is a tricky diplomatic task.
As he sat down with his Egyptian counterpart at the start of a busy day of meetings, Kerry said he's here to try to build on Egyptian efforts to resolve the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas.
And hopefully find not only a way to a ceasefire, but a way to deal with the underlying issues, which are very complicated.
U.S. officials say they believe that the Israeli military operation has degraded Hamas's capabilities, and Kerry's worried about the rising civilian death toll. He's announced $47 million in humanitarian aid. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Cairo.
The federal government says consumer prices rose last month. The Labor Department says they increased 0.3% in June. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist for PNC Financial. He says that shoppers saw some specific savings.
We got a little break at the grocery store. Food prices barely budged last month, according to this report. And car and truck prices actually fell, new and used. So people in the market for vehicles probably got a little break as well.
But energy prices rose 1.6% last month. That reflects the big jump in gasoline costs. Those were up well over 3% in June. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 53 points at 17,105. The NASDAQ is up 26 points at 4,451. The S&P 500 is up 8 points. You're listening to NPR.
It's 10:04. Good morning. I'm Lisa Miller, 90.7 WFAE News. A proposal that would prevent Mecklenburg County from putting a quarter-cent sales tax on the ballot this year is up for a vote this morning in the Senate Finance Committee. The bill would impose a 2.5% cap on local sales tax. Mecklenburg County is already at that limit. County commissioners had planned on asking voters in November to approve another quarter-cent sales tax to go mainly toward teacher pay. Yesterday, lawmakers amended the bill to give counties more flexibility on how to use that sales tax, but that wouldn't change anything for Mecklenburg County since the county is already levying the full 2.5%. Charlotte officials have not given up on the idea of storing millions of tons of coal ash at Charlotte Douglas International Airport. A city committee said yesterday Duke Energy is considering a counterproposal to the company's original idea of putting ash under the runways. It's unclear where the ash might go. An assistant city manager said he hopes to have a recommendation next month. City officials have looked at sites for the ash north and south of the airport's westernmost runway. Charlotte Douglas owns the land, but it's not used as part of the airfield. A new district court judge appointed by Governor McCrory was previously reprimanded for professional misconduct by the North Carolina State Bar. McCrory has appointed Michael Stone of Rayford to a state judicial seat in Hoke County. Records on file with Stone's law license show he was issued a written reprimand in 1998 after he and a law partner conducted real estate closings that were handled by assistants with no attorney present. The state bar concluded Stone and his partner didn't properly supervise her staff members and failed to review deeds and other important legal documents before they were filed. The governor's office says McCrory knew about Stone's reprimand before naming him as a judge and that McCrory didn't think one past mistake should disqualify Stone from consideration. Checking the weather this afternoon, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, cloudy with a high near 83. Tonight, more rain possible, or low around 72. And tomorrow, more chance of showers and thunderstorms, could clear up, partly sunny with a high near 88. It's 10:06 for 90.7 WFAE News. I'm Lisa Miller.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Israel continues to fire on targets in Gaza, and an Israeli soldier is reported missing. Diplomatic efforts to broker a ceasefire between Israel